The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It's hard to imagine a better expression of the theological vision we've been exploring over the last couple of weeks, this season of creation. It's a vision of the world coming forth from the vital being of God, flaming out like shining from shook foil, so that the created order communicates something of God's own nature, indeed is charged with it. We've been unpacking the theme, a home for all, renewing the oikos of God, which is the theme set for this year's season of creation by the Ecumenical Council. And I've suggested that we're truly at home in the world to the extent that we resonate with its originating vitality and recognise something of the love and gift that underlies the world's life. We're truly at home here insofar as we recognise our fellow creatures as sharers in this same gift of life, members with us of the household of God, the earth a home for all. Alas, says Gerard Manley Hopkins, this is not how we, especially in the industrialised West, have tended to live. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? The poet cries. Why do we not heed our proper place and relation to God and other beings? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. Not only are we often alienated from the world around us, nor can foot feel, being shod, but human activity has also profoundly affected the functioning of Earth's natural systems, the balance of things. There are places where, as Hopkins says, the soil is bare now, and the glaciers are melting now, the oceans acidifying. There are places where systems are so out of whack that some forms of life proliferate in, as it were, unnatural ways. Introduced and feral species, human overpopulation and overconsumption overwhelm the capacity of Earth's systems to cope. And the question we face, given all this, starting from here, is how may the Earth's life be renewed? How do we relate to our common home in ways that enable genuinely mutual flourishing? Well, as I sat with this theme this week, what struck me first of all is a sense of wonder that renewal is in fact a possibility. We're not part of a broken machine, but of a living system capable of healing, regeneration, and newness. It's an astonishing feature of our world, though theologically, it makes sense that it should be like this. If it's true that the earth communicates the nature of God, then it follows, as Hopkins says, that nature is never spent, never exhausted. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, because all are sourced in the irrepressible life of God. This doesn't mean we have license to rip and tear at will. We know that living systems can be pushed past certain tipping points, such that they cannot continue operating as they are created to. Yet it remains true that where there is life, there is hope and the possibility of life's renewal. Just this week, I've come across a couple of inspiring stories of the renewing of the natural world. On SBS News, we saw footage of urban forests growing in Karachi, in Pakistan. They're being planted on parched and degraded land in the middle of this megacity, starting to offer habitat for birds and other animals, dramatically reducing the ambient temperature and capable of holding thousands of gallons of runoff water after rain. We saw the before and after photographs, a miracle of renewal. And there was a story in the Monthly magazine about the Tasmanian devil. This small marsupial had been decimated by an epidemic of facial cancer, prompting heroic scientific efforts to create what they call an insurance population of devils in zoos and wildlife sanctuaries, including on the mainland, where devils once also lived. The population is now recovering, and there are discussions about the possibility of reintroducing the species to Australia's mainland. Now, this raises its own complexities and controversy, illustrating the delicate judgments involved in discerning how to rebalance damaged natural systems. But a recent field study found that introducing devils to an area hugely reduced the number of feral cats, and as that happened, the population of native mammals began to recover. It's hoped that Tasmanian devils may provide a unique opportunity to reset some of Australia's ecosystems with native carnivores and native prey, rather than overwhelmingly introduced predators. And I'm sure you're aware of other initiatives worldwide yielding heartening results. Rewilding projects, the recovery of some marine populations because of fishing quotas, organisations like Bush Heritage regenerating land and habitat, and work on recovering the health of river systems, including by our own John Williams in Northern Australia. And there are thousands of local waterways, parks, gardens being brought back to vibrant life by the love and hard work of communities. And what all this shows is that it is possible for the earth to regenerate, for species to recover, for life to flourish and find equilibrium again. This work of renewal calls for wisdom and patience. We don't always know how to create the conditions for it, what interventions are needed, and what is just about getting out of the way, giving life a chance to do what it needs. But it seems to me one of the great signs of hope in our time that such renewal is being imagined and is happening. And this leads me to reflect on a further dimension of this hope of renewal. It's to do with the way we speak about the natural world, the importance of how we imagine our relationship to it. Some thoughts of Simone Weil, philosopher, activist, and mystic, are helpful here. Weil was profoundly concerned about the treatment of workers in 1930s France. She spent time working in a Renault factory and was appalled at how being treated as a mere cog in the industrial machine affected her and her fellow workers, how it compromised something essential to their humanity. And yet she was also highly critical of the union movement advocating on these workers' behalf. For this movement framed the injustice of the situation merely in terms of the need for higher pay. Suppose, she wrote, the devil were bargaining for the soul of some poor wretch, and someone, moved by pity, should step in and say to the devil, it is a shame for you to bid so low. The commodity is worth at least twice as much. It's not that pay scales are irrelevant, but her point is that if this is the only language you have for conceiving human value, then something has already been lost. The workers, she says, forget that the subject of the bargain, which they complain they are being forced to sell cheap and for less than the just price, is nothing other than their soul. And it seems to me there's risk of a similar reductionism in some of the ways our society tries to characterise the value of the natural world. According to a 2010 discussion paper from the Australian Government's Environment Department, scientists and policymakers are increasingly using the concept of ecosystem services. Ecosystem services are defined as, quote, the mix of benefits that society obtains from our environment and whose continued provision underpins human existence, health, and prosperity. These so-called services include such things as the production of food and water, control of climate and disease, nutrient cycles and oxygen production. There is an attempt to include non-economic value as part of the service the environment is said to provide. There's talk of cultural, spiritual, and recreational benefits, as well as intrinsic value. But the whole framing of the discussion seems commodifying and anthropocentric. The world's value, defined primarily in relation to what it provides, the services it provides for us. I believe the motives for developing this concept are good. It's an effort to describe the natural world so that its value can be recognised and accounted for by our economic and policy frameworks. But my fear is that the concept concedes too much to these frameworks. Just as characterising the value of workers purely in terms of the price of their labour diminishes their humanity, so framing the value of the natural world in terms of its service provision to us flattens our perception of it and distorts our relationship to it. Such language cannot evoke wonder or make us present to the beauty and sheer mysterious otherness of the life around us. In a real sense, it doesn't know what it's talking about. Well, the letter of James speaks powerfully about the dangers of the misuse of the tongue. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire, and the tongue is a fire. It's hard not to hear this literally in our day when you think of the forest ablaze this past summer across Europe and North America and the year before in Australia, and they're fueling by delays in climate action due, in part at least, to the misuse of the tongue. Lies and conspiracy theories peddled by certain corporations, politicians, and media outlets. But as well as the question of untruth, I'm also suggesting that the right use of the tongue, of human speech, must also encompass the adequacy of the concepts with which we try to express the meaning of things. The right use of the tongue involves being aware of how our words, images, and rhythms of speech evoke or deny the fullness of reality, how they make us present or not, related or not. And this suggests that the language of poetry, worship, art, photography, music, and dance is not just ornamental or decorative, some kind of indulgent or, in principle, dispensable overlay on the real language of ecosystem services. Quite the opposite. This language of love and relationship is absolutely necessary if we are truly to connect and reconnect to the life in which we share. It plays as vital a part in renewing the world and our relationship to the world as the knowledge and wisdom of science and the dedication of conservationists. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. These are words that bless the earth. Once you've been helped to see it this way, then honour, celebration, and reverence follow. So too then, may our words of praise and thanksgiving participate in the renewing of the household of God.